Okay, we'll call the House Senate Conference Committee on Senate Files 0958 to order, and we'll get right into it. And I think what we're going to do today basically is take up the 2 hours with 40 minutes per, and it'll be the Commissioner of Corrections, followed by the Commissioner of DPS, followed by the Commissioner of the Human Rights Department. And so, Commissioner Roy, are you in the crowd? There we go. And you can bring whoever you'd like to the table with you. Mr. Roy, welcome to the conference committee. We're going to give each commissioner about 40 minutes. That includes the opening remarks, and then we have a whole litany of questions for you. And I don't know what the Senate is going to have a number of them, too. And if you would like to begin with your opening remarks, tell us whatever you would like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to introduce two sitting with me. To my left, Lisa Ogroski, Assistant Commissioner. And to my right, David Christ, Deputy Commissioner. It is important work that we're going to do today, and it is a area of interest keen to our citizens. And I know public safety is very important to all members on this committee, and that's a good thing. Citizens have a high expectation that our streets are safe, that our schools are safe. I would like to put this discussion into context, and the Department of Corrections is very fortunate in that we have an advantage over other departments, and the advantage we have at this point in time is that we have been subject to two important studies that were recently accomplished by the Pew Research Institute, the 1 in 100 report in 2008 and the 1 in 31 report in 2009. And the subject area for both those reports was the efficacy of corrections delivery systems throughout the United States. And in those two reports, Minnesota shines. And I cannot overstate the importance of those statistics. And I need to stress how important it is that you folks consider those statistics as you go about establishing important criminal justice policy and budgetary concerns. I will state these statistics, and I hope there's questions about them. Some of these you have heard in committee already, but I cannot overstate the importance of these statistics. Minnesota is 49th in corrections spending. 2.6% of our general fund goes towards correctional expenditures. Only Alabama spends less on corrections than Minnesota. As a comparison, a state with similar demographics is Wisconsin, and they spend 8% and almost twice as much annually for corrections. We are very fortunate in that regard, but the good story continues here. We are 49th in jail and prison incarceration. Only Maine locks up fewer people than Minnesota. We are 48th in the percent of workforce of state employees that are engaged in corrections, and we are at 5.2%. Hawaii and North Dakota have fewer state employees devoted to corrections. So we have three important statistics, all in the top three. What this should tell you folks, and it certainly tells me, is that we have remarkable performance. And since I've only been commissioner for about 3 months. I cannot claim success for these remarkable statistics. You may ask yourself, how did Minnesota become postured so positively in the big scheme of things? And about 30 years ago, probably in a chamber very similar to this, if it wasn't, could have been this one, two major public policy decisions were made. And that was the adoption of the sentencing guidelines, which moved from indeterminate sentencing to determinate sentencing. That movement gave Minnesota a huge advantage in identifying crimes that were absolutely the public demanded incarceration. It also moved away from the traditional parole board, which gave a lot of latitude in sentencing practice and release policy. With the sentencing guidelines, we are able to predict prison populations to about 1%. It's a remarkable tool that we've been given, and Minnesota has really benefited significantly by having sentencing guidelines. The other policy that was very significant, and that was the formation of the Community Corrections Act. Some very enlightened people, corrections policy folks, legislators, established that the best way to deliver corrections is in the community. And the Community Corrections Act formed agencies, allowed agencies to form and deliver very effective correctional services locally in terms of treatment, probation and parole supervision, and actually facilities as well. The major accomplishment for the large counties was to have their own detention facilities, their own treatment facilities, keeping offenders near to their community, their families, and their futures. These two initiatives set Minnesota on a course that has saved the taxpayers. I initially wrote millions here, and I crossed that out, and I'm going to say that those two policy decisions have saved Minnesota taxpayers billions of dollars. Additionally, we've had significant work by other public agencies, schools, social service agencies, police agencies have all worked and strived to move further upstream in ebbing the flow of offenders into our system. School police officers, community officers have been really significant to the work we do and affecting younger offenders. I need to talk a little bit about how corrections does not stand alone in the criminal justice world. We have an extremely professional police force, our sheriff's departments, our city police, our state police. We have effective professional prosecution. We have judges now that have been guided by best practices, by sentencing guidelines. And at the end of that process, corrections is engaged. And that engagement is the fourth leg of that very important stool. If, in fact, corrections does not handle offenders, treat offenders, provide the final stage of criminal justice, we have failed. I think the public has a high expectation that once an offender enters our authority, whether that be on probation, parole, or in our institutions, there's an extremely high expectation that we treat those offenders, that we get to the roots of their criminality, and that we release an offender who at the end of their stay with us is a better person, a more productive citizen. Minnesota has proved by the statistics I just related to you that we are effective, that we provide those services, and I think we sit here very confidently telling you that the offenders leaving our supervision are better people. Not all of them. I would be a very foolish man to sit here and tell you that we get to every offender, because we certainly don't. As we have looked at the House and Senate versions of this omnibus bill, there are a couple things that grab our attention. And rather than going into great detail with the bill, I'm going to make several broad comments here. One of the substantial parts of the House version is the requirement to complete many studies and reports. And all of these subject areas certainly are important in the criminal justice realm, whether that be probation incentives, sex offenders, juveniles, early release strategies. All of those items are definitely important. We are very concerned, however, that the time frame, if in fact the studies are required, that we have the manpower and the horsepower to produce those reports. We are also concerned that the potential for large budgetary savings as the result of those reports might not be realistic. We are not in a world that the academicians have not produced significant numbers of reports, and Minnesota has produced a lot of reports related to the subject areas included in the bill. And just to give you a flavor for some of those reports that have already been completed, I would like to read a list of those for you, and it won't take long. The Corrections Strategic Management and Operations Advisory Task Force, February 2010. A Review of Guidelines for the Revocation of Parole and Supervised Release, a 2009 report to the legislature. A Report on Conditional Release Program, a 2000 report to the legislature. The Delivery Systems Change Process, a Guidebook on Delivery System Transition, 2008. The Uniform Statewide Probation Outcome Measures Workgroup, 1998, report to the legislature. Minnesota Juvenile Justice and Mental Health Initiative, August 2008. Two reentry reports, an outcome evaluation of MnCorps' employee program, just released March 2011. An evaluation of Minnesota's Comprehensive Offender Reentry Plan, February 2010. Employment Services for Ex-Criminal Offenders Pilot Project, 2010 report to the legislature. Final report on the Serious Offender Accountability Restoration Project, October 2006. In regard to sex offenders, and this I know is a keen interest to this group, a recently, just this week, released report, A Reasoned Approach, Reshaping Sex Offender Policy to Prevent Child Abuse, produced by the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers. The legislative auditor, just this year, of course, released the high-profile civil commit of sex offender, the impact of prison-based treatment on sex offender recidivism, evidence from Minnesota, March 2010, the effects of failure to register on sex offender recidivism, March 2010, Megan's Law in Minnesota, the impact of community notification on sex offender recidivism, May 2008. Sex offender recidivism in Minnesota, April 2007. Residential proximity and sex offense recidivism in Minnesota, April 2007. Minnesota's sex offender management, final report to the legislature, February 2007. Working group on sex offender management, 2006. Progress report to the legislature, January 2006, and Level 3 Sex Offender Residential Placement Issues, 2003, report to the legislature, 2004, February. Clearly, many criminal justice reports have been done. We are always interested in doing things better. We're always interested in accessing the best information possible to form corrections policy. And as a department, we will always be engaged in those initiatives. Our concern with the bill is that there are so many, the time frame is so short, Some of these subject areas have already been visited in the courts and in previous studies. So I would urge the committee, as you form your final bill, that you scrutinize these in light of some of the reports that I have just read. I would also be remiss in my comments here if I didn't mention the role of community resources, not related to the corrections department, but people, some sitting in the room right now, that provide treatment in the community, chemical dependency treatment, mental health, vocational reentry activities, all towards the public mission of improving public safety. If, in fact, all those duties were heaped on the shoulders of a corrections department, we would be buried. We simply could not provide those levels of services in our communities. And it's important work, and I would urge the committee to consider the importance of those initiatives as well, recognizing, of course, that they do have budgetary impact as well. We have Mr. Chris next to me has been long in the department, is in charge of our prison system, has a long work history as a corrections officer, as a manager in our department. Ms. Ogrosky has a similar history working in institutions and is clearly our budget expert. She has legacy information and knowledge about days gone by that has been very valuable to me and may certainly be valuable to you as a committee. We have tried to maintain our approach, our academic approach to some of these considerations, and I hope that as we answer your questions today, we can provide you with good information as you form your policies as well. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments.
Thank you, Commissioner Roy. We'll probably have the time at the very end to if you wanted to respond to any of the things in general to speak again. The first question I would have is, one thing that's it's confusing for us is that one of the things you really hit hard on in your letter back to us was short-term offenders. Yet the very first study that you mentioned, which was a good study on the February 2010 by Correction Strategic Management and Operations Advisory Task Force, recommended that no person less than 30 days be sent to state prison. But yet we've got hundreds of them in there. And the task force in general that you mentioned that you thought would take up a lot of time and expense, the recommendation also from this report was to convene a cross-entity task force to look at consistency of revocation guidelines, policies, and practice related to technical violations, including warrants. And that was one of the things that we directed you towards. I guess my question is, what recommendations and task force do you listen to, or which ones do you just go your own way? Because this was one out of four different, a study from within, a professional consultation, a Randall Weber study. I think there was a fourth one that all directed that we should not be sending prisoners to state prison for such short terms. But you were directly against that. And so I'm wondering, how did you come to that conclusion? And in future task force or things gather up to make a statement what you should do, and you do just the opposite or support the opposite. If you could talk for a couple of minutes on that.
Mr. Chair, certainly my stating these reports, please don't make the presumption that I would support every notion or every recommendation within those reports. My listing of those reports was only presented to the committee to tell you that there has been, in a number of areas, studies and some recommendations certainly that should find their way into policy and some that may not. The previous administration certainly spent a lot of time on sex offender strategies. Some of those strategies found themselves into law and practice. Some did not. The recent release of the Legislative Auditor's Report certainly had some suggestions, not only for our system, but for the civil commitment process as well. Whether those things find themselves into law or into practice, I don't know yet. And I think the fruits of some of those studies have yet to be realized.
The Representative Woodard, do you have
a... Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Roy, I was interested in your conversation or your testimony regarding recidivism rates. And as you're probably aware, the Pew Center came out with a study recently, just this year, that says Minnesota has the worst recidivism rate in the country at 61.2% of people being released from our correctional facilities being reintroduced into the correction facilities. And that was actually an increase of about 6%. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing to work towards those recidivism rates or work bringing those recidivism rates down?
Commissioner. Chair, Representative, it is recidivism is how we measure success, and that's the bottom line. Every activity we do, every program, every initiative should relate to reducing recidivism. The Pew study, and we could spend hours talking about the research and how those numbers were arrived at. I would rather not do that in this format, but to get to your question, the reentry efforts, our education programs, our vocational programs, our treatment programs, our mental health initiatives all relate to recidivism reduction. The statistics that we have great confidence in is that in 2007, because recidivism studies have to go back a significant number of years, that return to prison for a new felony conviction was 23.4%, which was a 6% reduction from 2004. Return to prison for a violation of supervised release, 35.7%, a 5% reduction from 2004. And a return to prison for any reason in 2007 was 48%, a 5% decrease from 2004. Obviously, I can't claim to be a part of that success, but I would certainly note that that number is going the right way. Anytime we start talking about a decrease in return to prison, that's a good thing. And I would rely on the strength of our treatment, the treatment in our communities that I referenced earlier, our vocational partners learning vocational skills in prison and being able to continue those activities once they're released. Reentry has been a huge initiative. We were the recipient of a grant throughout the nation. The Obama administration has gone to great lengths. In fact, it's probably the only area that he has spoken very publicly about in the midst of all the other concerns is the reentry of prisoners back into the community and how important that is. I hope I can sit here next year and tell you that our statistics show that we have had even more of a decrease. But again, Minnesota is postured a little differently than most other states. Because of the sentencing guidelines that I referenced, only the worst of the worst go to our prisons. So that reentry and the return of high numbers to prison is not necessarily always a bad thing, because sometimes those folks are returned to prison when they start displaying behaviors that line them up for more serious criminal conduct. So we have aggressive probation, aggressive parole officers, and before the behaviors of those prisoners get too extreme, they are violated. And I think the public demands that. I don't think anybody in this room would support probation violators, parole violators, continuing to walk around in our communities without some intervention. So on one hand, high recidivism, high return rates to prison are a bad thing, and I think people could make a case for that. But on the other hand, I think there can be a strong case made for good supervision in the community and stopping criminal conduct.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Woodard.
Well, I appreciate that, Commissioner Roy. I think that, you know, in your earlier statement when you talked about being proud of the fact that the correctional facilities are able to address some of these issues and lower recidivism rates was on the right target. I mean, I understand that if, you know, you recommit that you need to go back to jail, and I think you're right, that or back to prison, that we all would agree upon that. Question is, you know, whether all of the programs that we have are really addressing the recidivism rate, which, as you mentioned, is our number one measure of success. And as a follow-up to that, I know that as I was going through some of these numbers that the total central office is about, I guess according to the end of FY 2010, was about 13.17% of the budget, and that prior to that, in the end of FY 08, that percentage was about 8.02 or 8.04. I think it's 8.02. Is there a reason for that jump in the central office?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would defer to those with legacy knowledge, and Lisa Ogrosky certainly can provide that.
Ms. Ogrosky, your commissioner, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, can you tell me which document you're looking at specifically? It might help me answer the question.
This is the statutory per diem document that we have from, I think this is from the department, yeah, from the Minnesota Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, those central office costs that are included on that one line are probably going to include additional costs as we were renting a significant number of beds at that point. So there are additional costs at our central office when we contract out with other places. We have case management costs. We have contract administrators. There could be a few other costs also that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head, but I think a significant portion of that is probably due to the rental of beds.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Commissioner, there was a trying to find my spot here. Well, here it is. By the way, if we don't get done in our allotted time in 10 more minutes for yours, would it be okay if we fired off the remaining questions to you, if you could get back to them fairly quickly? I think it'll be statistics and things that would be readily available to you and help us. And maybe it was a mistake in the calculations, but your letter cited House and Senate's reduction to community service funding yet, but in my chart it shows all of them were the same, $632,000, the House and the Senate and the governor. You cited some concern. You, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, you have a less... The House has less of a cut than the Senate to community services.
How did you, Commissioner, how did you come up with back to the task force? One of the things that we'd ask you to do is we don't need you to call in a bunch of user groups or huge groups. These studies that we've asked you to do or form huge task force, but you did come up with an estimation of $100,000 per task force. How did you come up with that figure?
Mr. Chair, I would again defer to Ms. Ogrosky.
Commissioner Ogrosky?
Mr. Chair, we use that as an example that a report or a study can cost up to that amount of money. That cost actually was based on the corrections task force, the efficiency task force, that was just completed last year. We had to contract with Management Analyst Division for a facilitator, and that also included the internal staff time that went into that task force.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sorry, I don't want to be taking all the time here on the House side. If any folks can jump in any time you want. We just formed a large number of questions here. If you could go over inmate health care a little bit, and is there room for it seems like we're treating the inmates pretty well, medical and dental, and we're naturally wondering how much you can shave off of that in some matter or fashion. And it would seem that we were giving actually better treatment than they probably could on MinCare. But go ahead, Commissioner Crist.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is David Crist. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Facility Services. Just a very, very brief history of healthcare in the Department of Corrections. Probably 12 years ago, 15 years ago, we had over 115 contracts, separate contracts, that were administered out of the central office of the Department of Corrections to deliver health care to our offenders. About 12 to 15 years ago, we contracted with Correctional Medical Services so that we now write one contract with CMS, who subcontracts for the rest of our medical care. They are, in effect, an HMO for correctional medical service delivery. They've got the expertise and utilization in managing pharmacies and in deciding what sort of medical procedures our inmates ought to have. And we think literally that they've saved us millions of dollars over the years by going through that process. Some of the current drivers in cost of medical for us right now is what we are required to pay to physicians and physician groups, the cost of hospital bed days, the number of offenders that we've got in our system who now require dialysis treatment and treatment for various cancers and heart disease that are all very high-cost items. If I recall Ms. Larson's testimony from earlier in the year, we don't provide even the same level of treatment as some of the community health insurance plans. For instance, there might be some requirements under Medicare or Medicaid for, let's say, a person on the street who has breast cancer to have reconstructive surgery following that. In our facilities, we've got a female offender who developed breast cancer since she's been with the Department of Corrections, and we've declined to provide her with the reconstructive surgery that she probably would be entitled to out on the streets. That's one example of how we make determinations as to what is medically necessary for an offender to maintain a working lifestyle, not a medical extravagance.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Senator Limmer.
I had a question. The Minnesota Senate Judiciary Committee discussed the possibility of increasing inmate copays, and it was only $2 more than the existing rate. Did you folks have an opinion on that?
Commissioner Crist?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I think we're pretty neutral on that. We like the fact that offenders don't come to our health services anymore for trivial matters. We think that the $3 health care copayment helped with that. We think that the $5 will help with that. I'm talking about things like showing up at sick calls saying, you know, I've got a headache this morning, I need a couple of aspirin. That wastes the nurse's time. It adds cost to the system that we could be spending on more deserving offenders with legitimate ailments.
I had a question. when I presented it, there was some concern about whether or not the inmates had the ability to afford that, since they're paid a very nominal fee for any labor that they do within the institution. But having been familiar with correction institutions, I also know that relatives and family and others can contribute to their account also. And we sometimes forget that discussion when we're only focusing on inmate income. And so as a result of that, I thought that it was a reasonable thing. Everyone else's health care is going up. And I don't know when the last time copay was raised, but it doesn't raise a lot of money, but it does help contribute to the cause. Thank you.
Moving on into another area, if that one's done. IT directors, how many does the department have, and is it possible you could cut down on that number? Either one, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the IT discussions, certainly the effects information. Let me back up. I'm not sure we have what you're calling a director, but we have any number of management positions within the IT department. You're absolutely right. Information sharing, maintaining accurate information is an incredibly important job for the Department of Corrections when we're basing sentencing information, release decisions, medical records. All of those things require the efficient flow of information, and we constantly examine the efficiencies in management, and we, Ms. Ogrosky, I think, can give you a history of some reductions within that department as well.
Commissioner Ogrosky.
How
do you pronounce your name again?
It's Ogrosky.
Ogrosky, there we go.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, our agency has taken significant strides over the last 10 years, especially in the Operations Support Division, which is a lot of the administration functions, to try to streamline activities. Our IT department actually has gotten a little bit larger, but that's because we use technology far more than we ever used to. We used to have information technology directors at every one of our prisons. That has since been regionalized. There are not 10 of them anymore. I believe there are 4. So they manage the IT functions for multiple facilities. We also have an information and technology director who manages all of IT and our research division. We have a chief information officer who plays a very significant role in the agency. But we have made significant strides to reduce the number of positions in this area, or to make, I shouldn't say reduce, not in IT we didn't reduce, but we made it more efficient. We made the management of the unit more efficient to ensure we have consistency throughout the organization and to provide IT services not just to the Department of Corrections, but to our corrections partners, Department of Public Safety, local law enforcement. We provide IT information to probation officers throughout the state also.
Thank you. Nearing the end of their time for this department, has anybody got any questions left? Commissioner, if we could have staff take the remaining questions and send them to you on an email, if you could do your best to get right back to us. And also, I'll have my my CA here give you my personal cell number if you haven't already got it. And I just want to make sure that you folks have open access at any time to us. There's been some question lately on how much input we've given you, and hopefully, why don't you take a couple of minutes to close and just realize that Senator Limmer and I are open questions or input in the interim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I know both of you are really committed to public safety. I know committee members are as well. It's a universal concept that government has the ultimate responsibility for protecting our citizens. When the big announcement of the terrorist that was killed last week, I thought to myself, in the daily lives of Minnesota citizens, he probably played a relatively minor role. There are certainly citizens amongst us who cause terror to our communities, and all of us around these tables have that responsibility to deal with our local offenders, those that cause harm, those that kidnap, murder, and I could, the whole litany of crimes that we read about every day on the front page. I hope at the end of the day, I hope in 2 weeks, we can all look in the mirror and say that we have done a better job for Minnesota in terms of delivering criminal justice services and maintaining public safety. I've devoted my whole career to this, and I know that there are people around this table that have done similar efforts, and we take it very seriously, and it's a daily mission that we're on to improve the lives of our citizens. So I appreciate the time, and certainly we'll respond to your questions as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And even though we have a few differences in how we think we should form your budget, we do have a respect for each one of you and the job that you hold. So look forward to talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Doman. Welcome, Commissioner Doman. Good to see you. And if you would like to make some opening remarks before questions, feel free.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. First of all, I'd like to say I have Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison with me. I know that most of you know her quite well. I came in kind of late in the session, and I know some of you, but not all of you. And so my intention is to get around to actually have more conversation with you as we work through this process and beyond. But I'd just like to thank you for allowing us the time to share our concerns and to have this discussion. I know that you are all in receipt of the letter that I sent to you back on May 3rd, and I would just like to quickly point out the major areas of concern or interest that we have, and then we obviously will be open for any questions that you might have beyond that. The first one that I'd like to talk about is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As you know, the Bureau is actually essentially a service agency for provides a lot of services for local law enforcement throughout the state of Minnesota. And the cuts, the core functions are the laboratory, MINJIS, the Minnesota Justice Information Systems Services Division, and then certainly the investigative division of the BCA. My concern with the cuts to the BCA is just that this shifts some costs back to the local agencies, where local agencies are already feeling the burdens of LGA cuts and other diminishing budgets. And so we're concerned that historically the BCA has been able to provide a lot of these services to local agencies, and we would not be able to continue to do that under some of these proposed cuts. The Office of Justice Programs, the sizable cuts to this division would have a profound impact on the vital services that we provide throughout the state of Minnesota. And as I listened to Commissioner Roy's testimony about recidivism in the state, in particular, eliminating the justice grants really terminates the only community-based crime prevention funding provided by the state and reduces funding for youth intervention programs, where we really believe that if we can work with the youth on the front end, we can hopefully diminish the numbers that go into the systems on the other end. And so that is a concern of ours. Both the House and Senate did not fund the one-time request for the Network for Better Futures. This is a successful societal reentry program, and again, speaks to the corrections piece of this too, where this is a known successful program, and if we're looking at recidivism and keeping numbers out of our prison systems, this is certainly a program that is worth funding. The 911 special revenue account, the one-time transfer, we are very concerned about this, and I'll let Deputy Commissioner Ellison speak more to this after I've presented my overview. But there are some very strong concerns that we have with that piece. The fire safety special revenue account, we're just somewhat disappointed about the one-time transfer from that account. The fire safety account is a dedicated fund derived from a surcharge on fire insurance premiums and has statutorily directed uses. And then certainly we've just completed or just about completed our flood stage here in Minnesota, and the lack of funding for the local FEMA disaster match assistance stemming from the 2009 floods is a concern of ours, leaving impacted localities to cover more than $800,000 in programs or projects that have already been started or else just not completed at this present time, and that is a concern to us. But I appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion, and we're very open to more discussion or to answer any of your questions at this time. Deputy Commissioner Ellison, would you like to? Could I defer to the Deputy Commissioner?
Commissioner, you bet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. As Commissioner Dolan mentioned, we have a lot of concern over the special revenue, the 911 special revenue fund, and taking that fund, taking money from those funds. As we have testified in front of both the committees in the House and Senate and sent letters, and Kristen Anderson from MMB also sent a letter about the transfer of these funds. We really do believe it's going to impact our bond rating, and we do really believe that it's going to impact our ability to receive federal funds of $1.4 million because there is federal legislation specifically that says 911 funds can only be collected if they're used for 911 purposes. And so I can certainly give you more detail on that, but we have a very real concern about that. And again, Commissioner Doman has mentioned the highlights. We feel like we've done the best job we can giving you as much detail on each one of these programs. And we're here today, and we have our agency division directors here to answer any specific questions that you have.
All right, thank you, Commissioners. The first one I got is just in general. I don't consider a 1.5% cut to the BCA a large cut. Everybody this year is taking somewhat of a cut, but and I would definitely be against charging back to the agencies for the services, because it would be I'd hate to somebody. Would have to determine the length and depth of their investigation to depend on how much money they had to pay for somebody's fingerprints or ballistic testing or something like this. How do you figure that that's such a large cut to the BCA?
Mr. Chair, if I might answer that, I think this is the reason that we believe that this cut is large is because it follows cuts that have been made over the past biennia, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has already been reduced several hundred thousands of dollars. There were permanent cuts made to their administration budget. I believe the total cut to BCA over the years has been over 4%. And so this is an additional 1.3 to 1.5% on top of that. And so we get down to the point where we can't simply keep absorbing this within the administration of the BCA, and the logical impact is that we have to start charging for some of our services or passing some of these costs along.
It do I have my facts right here in either commissioners? In 1997, the BCA had 207 FTEs. 217, you currently have 367, a 70% increase in 14 years. And why the huge increase? How does that shake out?
Mr. Chair,
ask him to repeat the
numbers. Mr. Chair, could you repeat those numbers again, please?
If they are correct, 1997, the BCA, 217 FTEs, field training equivalents, full-time equivalents, excuse me, I get my terms mixed up. And then you currently have 367, a 70% increase. Could you go over that a little and if that's accurate or not?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to see if you could, whoever compiled that information, give it to me, because we have actually reduced agents over the years. Now, we have taken on some more programs from, like, Internet Crimes Against Children. We did get 10 agents at one point to address specifically methamphetamine. But our agent numbers have actually been decreasing overall over the years. And so I don't know if it's through the Criminal Justice Information System or MNJIS or where you're seeing those additions, but I'd like to look at that more closely and then follow up with you.
Have Mr. Carter address that. Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the chair asked me to go back to 1997. What we have here is a document from the 1997 budget book, and it says actual FTEs in 1997 for the total BCA were 217, and we could have a copy made for them, Mr. Chair, if they would like.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Carter, I think what has happened since 1997 is that there's been an explosion in the requirements under MNJIS, and that probably most of those positions are not in special agent, not in the lab, not in some of those core services, but in improving the Minnesota's justice information system, and we've received grants and special allocations over the years from the legislature to do that work.
Okay. Commissioner, director wanted to say something.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. We were just clarifying some information that we gave. Thank you.
Okay. The Representative Woodard question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testifiers. You on the 911 fee, we were talking about your concern that it might affect our bond rating, that you're concerned with that part of the process. But I didn't hear a lot about what you think the impact would be without that money and whether there's excess money in that account. Is this a case where you think maybe that fee is too high or that you're just really concerned about the bond rating?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodward,
sure.
Money accumulates in that account in order to buy equipment and to pay off the bonds to the bondholders. And so at first blush, it would look like we're accumulating excess funds, but all of those funds, if you look at the spreadsheet out into the future, have been allocated for paying off the bonds and paying off the interest on the bonds to the bondholders. And so, no, we do not feel that there's excess money sitting in that account. It's just that we have to collect the money over time in order to pay off the bonds and the interest on the bonds until they're paid off.
And, Mr. Chair, for just a quick follow-up.
Yes, Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. So what you're saying is that if the bond rating was not the issue, if the paying off the bonds was not the issue, and I think there's an argument on both sides of that, and I understand where you're coming from, but I think there's just a legitimate argument on the other side of that, that this would not affect our bond rating. The armor system would not be affected directly if you take the bond piece out of it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodward, we wouldn't be able to build out the system throughout the state of Minnesota. The system has not yet been built out, and so it would stop that progress, and some of the areas of the state would not have an armor system.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Woodard.
Do you know how many counties are opting out of the armor system? Are these counties that are desperately in need of the armor system that that you believe
Mr.
would
Chair,
be
Representative Woodward, I'm going to ask Jackie Mines, the director of the Emergency Communications Networks, to give you more detail.
Sure. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 71 counties have opted in at this point. Obviously, some of that depends on whether or not they, you know, come up with the local funds, but their intention is to move forward on the armor build-out.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair?
Representative Woodard.
Are you aware of any other states that have done this and have not been challenged by the FCC or by the bond ratings?
There is a move in many states to build an interoperable system, and you know, every state is kind of challenged, but the overall goal by the National Emergency Management is that there would be interoperable communications within states and then across border states.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodward, I'm not sure if this is responsive to your question, but other states who have taken 911 fees to backfill their general fund have found that they are no longer eligible for federal grants. We receive $1.4 million a year because of the FCC language that says if you have laws to collect 911 fees from telephone companies and you use that 911 fee for a different purpose, then you have to certify that you haven't done that. If you can't certify that you haven't done that, you lose the opportunity to have the federal grants.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Woodard.
This is my final question on the 911 fee, so I appreciate your indulgence here. But if we were not to do that, if we were to leave that money in the 911 account, where would BCA, for example, where would we be able to find those additional funds within the BCA budget to help backfill that, to make sure that we don't take out the 911 fee. Do you have any ideas for that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Woodward, BCA isn't funded through the 911 fee.
Mr. Chair, and
Representative Woodward.
Yeah, I understand that. What I'm saying is that this is a backfill, as you call it. We're taking this money to be able to fund the rest of the public safety budget. If we didn't have that money would have to be found somewhere. We have budget targets. We have to. This is our limit here. Is there another area that we should be looking at that would have less of an effect, in your opinion? I know it's a tough question. I don't need you to get into detail. I just mean, is there areas that would have less of an impact on our public safety than the 911 fee?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodward, we would encourage you to adopt the governor's budget.
Yeah.
Commissioner, how many threats have actually been carried through on that federal issue you talked about, no longer available? Because I see here states are doing it anyway.
There's a federal report that the FCC has put together, and I don't know the number off the top of my head, but approximately, I believe, 12 or 13 states have become ineligible for funding because of 911 fees being put into the general fund. But I can get specific information and get that back to you.
Anybody else so far? Yeah, Representative Kelly.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I guess I need to follow up with Representative Woods' question. He simply asked a question. This is a prioritizing. This is our budget bill. This was a backfill situation. So in the priority situation here, Commissioner, where else would you get the dollars? If you're prioritizing, if we don't go to this line item, where do we go then to get the dollars within your budget?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, that really would be up to your review and up to your decision. We support the governor's budget. The governor did fully fund public safety and reflects the priorities that he has. We support his budget, and if you wanted to take the $5.2 million from somewhere else, that really would be up to you to direct that.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the point being, we simply did ask for your opinion. We're asking for your opinion on help there, so that's what this hearing's about as well. So if you don't have an opinion, I appreciate that as well. Thanks.
It is a tough subject. We, on some studies, people adhere to, some think the studies are wrong, the fiscal notes that we've getting so far this year are pretty much of a joke, and so it's a real tough problem we're facing here in this committee, and that's why we're asking for your input, and if you put it back on to us, that's proper, and we can do that, but we just want to give you every chance before we make those decisions. The $1.23 million for police... Oh, excuse me. Who's got it? Senator Ortman, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. I have to follow on what Representative Kelly said. I'm unimpressed that you're not willing to help us identify your priorities. I think you need to, because we are going to set ours, and we'd like your input. And so my question was going to be, and Representative Kelly got there first, if these aren't the reductions that you would make with this budget target, what would they be? And I think that's a very fair question. So that at least if we're looking at the reductions, we're looking at the best ones or the least impactful ones to the whole view of public safety. And really, you are the experts. You're supposed to have your arms around the entire issue, all of your responsibilities to the entire state. And if you can't help us prioritize, and we're going to have to do it ourselves without your expertise and without your input. And I think that would be terribly unfortunate. And I think it would be a great disservice to the entire state and all of the residents that you are here equally to serve. So please don't separate yourself from what we're trying to do here. Take some responsibility and help us identify your priorities and make some smart and wise decisions so that when this bill gets to the governor, it is the best we can do. And then we can negotiate about what the best is from our perspective and what his is. But please weigh in and don't just walk away and leave us to ourselves unless you're going to say that we have adopted the best methodology and the best reductions given our target.
Chair, Senator Ortman, what I would say is that each one of the things that we do within the Department of Public Safety were mandated by the legislature. They aren't things that we thought up on our own or decided that, gee, this would be fun to do. The governor's priorities are reflected in his budget. And if you feel that the governor's priorities are misplaced, then it's certainly within your purview to direct funds in a different direction.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dorman.
Again, Commissioner, really unimpressed. We don't want to talk right now about the governor's priorities. We're talking about our priorities. And the mandates come from law. We have the statutory authority to change the law. So we're trying to say, where is our money best spent if this is all we have? And I have to tell you, families do this. Businesses do this. Local law enforcement agencies do this same thing. And we're asking you to weigh in with your expertise and provide us some guidance. And say that if you have to reduce by $5.2 million, maybe this fund, the 911 fund, isn't the best fund, and maybe there's another way to do this. Or maybe we have some attrition in one of these programs, and we don't need to backfill these positions. But we're asking you to engage with us on our proposal. And if we have to do without you, then we'll do without you, and we'll go and negotiate with the governor. But I think that it is incumbent upon you to help us with this process. And if we can roll back some of these mandates and spend the money in the best way, I think you should help us.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Ellison, I've been trying to track some numbers of the BCA, and I know that about in 1996, 97, is that what it was, Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, members, in 1997, which would be for the 98-99 biennium, the appropriation to the BCA at the end of the conference committee was $72.8 million. The Senate position and the House position, which are very close, this year is roughly $80 million. So about $7.2, $7.3 million increase in 14 years, which comes, you know.
That's about a 10% increase over that time?
Over 14 years, correct.
All right. And I noticed that in tracking some of the numbers back in 2008 and 9, the BCA had jumped considerably, $7 million up from an 81,745 in the 2006 and 7 spending cycle, up the next one in the 2008 and 9 to 88,000. So they had about a 6.5 million roughly increase. And then after that, 2010, 2012, 13 is kind of kept relatively flat at about $81 million. And the proposal we're proposing is $81 million minus, at least in the Senate and House, we're roughly $1 to $1.2 million difference compared to the $81 million that they have had for four to 5 years. And so I remember when we had our discussion with then Commissioner Doman, we had asked the department if there's any way to give us some direction on how you as an agency would redirect the resources. We were welcome to that, and we were encouraging of that. And I fear that we're getting a little bit of a stonewall today when we're asking for your help. I'll tell you right now, we aren't going to find $5 billion new dollars out of the pockets of our taxpayers. And we want to prioritize. This budget is focused on a priority-based budget. And we convinced Senate leaders that this was going to be taken care of. This budget was going to reflect the priorities, certainly reflective of where the governor's looking at setting priorities, but it also reflects some of the priorities that our leaders in our respective chambers have created in reference to all of the other budget concerns that they have. Now, I thought we were hoping, at least I was hoping, I'm a new guy running a committee as a chair, and I had hoped that this type of a partnership in trying to solve a budget, a difficult budget, we reached out to ask for ideas, partnership in this, and now all we're getting at is adopt the governor's budget. And I don't find that as a cooperative gesture. We've got difficult problems, and I don't think that either chamber is going to come up with $5 billion new dollars. And so as we progress through the discussions in the next few days, I hope that we could come around to trying to find. And I don't know what our budget targets are. The Senate is a little better than the House. And quite honestly, I don't think the budget from the Senate, it has nowhere to go but down. And so we're going to need your cooperation. And I hope we could have it before the end of the year.
Commissioner, do you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the figures with regarding the BCA, what I would like to do is look back. I know that BCA took over the MNJIS system, and that probably added to their budget, and I'd have to go back and look at those figures. The 4% that I was referencing was over the last two biennia. We looked back and saw that they had taken a reduction and an ongoing reduction, I believe, of $250,000 a year in their administrative budget. In terms of priorities, again, I can state that we're here to represent the governor's budget. We know it's a tough task. We know that you take public safety seriously and that you may make some cuts that are difficult to make.
Okay. Director Berger is sitting there. You know that I'm a big fan of the BCA, but we have to ask these hard questions, and I'm just trying to get to the bottom of why a 1.5% cut is a big cut, and I actually didn't think that. So I know if you wanted to respond.
No, I agree with Deputy Commissioner Ellison. If I could take a look back, if you're talking about the 97, 98, and then up to the present, we did combine the CRIMNET and CGIS operations, which would be an increase. Also, we moved into the larger facility back in about 2005. We do have support staff there. We've taken on ICAC, the Internet Crimes Against Children Project. There's any number of things that we do now that we didn't do before, Mr. Chair. And we're prioritizing all the time within our own division. And we're looking at the needed services for law enforcement. We assist the courts. This is an ongoing process. And it's just not something we do once a year during budget time. This is a continuation of something we do all the time. If we have services that aren't being used or aren't being requested by local agencies or prosecutors, we have to take a look at those, and we will redirect if we need to. So this is ongoing, sir, and I appreciate the fact that you are asking the hard questions. I want you to have the information that you need in order to do your work, so I'm very appreciative of that.
Okay, thank you, Director. Anybody for this one, either Commissioner, $1.23 million for police training and development. Is that the police training and development the BCA puts on at various places through the state where the BCA puts on police officer training, or it doesn't have anything to do actually with the money that comes back from POST? I think that's a separate thing. But what's the $1.23 million for police training and development? What section?
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Ms.
Where are you looking at?
I'm looking on my cheat sheet, but I'll find out where
it
is.
I'm sorry.
While Mr. Carter's looking for that, I'll go to OJP if that's okay. Commissioner Doman, you have authority over OJP. The director? I mean, you're the responsible person.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. I want to vault off on a number of things about OJP, and I want to make sure these are my thoughts. I not necessarily blame anybody else for them, but this division needs a lot of work. It seems, my opinion after we looked at it fairly closely, is that you get a lot of staff, a lot of positions, a lot of high-paid people, and the people that they give the grants to have got a lot of high-paid people in the positions. And they told us that, none of that was state money, and it's kind of a different kind of interpretation, because if you give an organization money, if a lot of their money is being sucked away by a person that's getting $200,000 a year for their salary. Of course, some of that state money, because it's going to be backfilling. And they seem to be giving out the grants more than merit-based. It's just find out how many people are applying to the grant, divide it into that, and give them each $43,000 or something like this. I wish there was more determination and more merit-based, because with all the FTEs they have, it's a huge chart in OJP, which we'll get to also, it just seems like they're not really merit-based. And so that was some of our direction at cutting overall. Your letter, I thought, mischaracterized it a little bit. What we're doing is saying that the battered women's shelters can only get cut a maximum of 11%. They might not get cut at all. So that's up to OJP. And so they probably would have rather had us go in and make the cuts ourselves to each part to take the blame off of them. But what we did was make the huge cut overall and let them, you know, figure out based on merit or who shouldn't even get one at all in these tough times. The other thing it looked like is that we're making a state budget of what was supposed to be a grant program. Continually every year somebody getting the same amount of money. Pretty soon they depend on that, and all of a sudden the sky is falling when they don't get it, rather than look at supplemental funds to their mission. So that's the problem we found with the OJP, the high salary and the one battered women's shelter, the large amount of reserve balances, the $20 million. It's grown from 29 people to 41 this year, 42% increase in 11 years. And so we're just wondering about the auditing for this, you know, how much control that is going to be given to them in the coming biennium.
Mr. Chair, you're correct. We didn't in the letter separate that percentage out between battered women's shelters and the other. I'm going to ask Deputy Commissioner Ellison to respond to your question. She actually has some institutional historical knowledge of OJP. And then we also have Jerry Bovaire in the audience if we have further follow-up questions.
And I'm sorry, Commissioner Ellison, that I asked so many questions at once instead of taking, but with the time, I just wanted to give you a general overview of why we were so concerned with this division.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me just say, I don't think it's any state salary that's $200,000 a year, I want to make sure that's on the record. We do have a staff of lots of people in the Office of Justice Programs, and we have take our responsibility for auditing those programs very seriously. And again, these are programs that were created by the legislature, and we had advisory committees made up of people from throughout the state that helped us set the parameters and helped us set the amount of funding that should go to the various categories of serving crime victims. We do consider this a core part of the overall public safety system, providing services to battered women, victims of sexual assault, victims of child abuse. The other reason that we have high scrutiny on these grants, therefore you have to have a certain number of staff, is that most grantees receive a combination of federal funds and state funds. And when they receive a combination of funds like that, we have to adopt the federal standards, which are very, very high for monitoring these grants. Again, in the law enforcement area, too, we have ongoing grants. The narcotics task forces and task forces that address violent crime get funds year after year after year, and so we could make the same argument for law enforcement, that they've come to rely on these on a local basis, and therefore we should end that process and put in place a competitive process, and we certainly are looking at that. Right now we're looking at going through a competitive process for every single grant that we offer and, you know, starting the process over again in all of our grant categories, for all of the categories that receive funding year after year after year, because we've heard the concern that the legislature has. In terms of the budget reserves and the salaries of battered women's directors, I have been at this process for many, many years, because prior to becoming deputy commissioner, I was director of the Office of Justice Programs, and it's very difficult when you talk about salaries of some individual people. Just like if you look at any institution, you have to consider the variety of programs that they manage, and some of the programs that have directors that receive higher salaries, they're not just running battered women's shelters, they're running many, many programs for a very large not-for-profit organization. those organizations have to follow IRS standards. Those IRS standards indicate that the board of directors for that agency has to look at the competitive nature of what positions are paid for like levels of responsibility. So those boards of directors aren't just pulling those salaries out of the air. They're really monitoring their what they pay their directors. And again, they have to meet IRS standards, because if you overpay a director of a not-for-profit, you stand some pretty stiff penalties if you're a member of a board of directors that does that. So it's very, very difficult to pull little bits of information and then say, well, this must mean that they're not well managed. It's a very complicated, difficult area to look at. But I can tell you, we've been looking at this for years. Battered women's programs in particular have really, really heightened their standards of oversight, and I think are doing a very good job under very difficult circumstances around the state.
Commissioner, I understand that, and we know how the program was originated. The point I was getting at is that the oversight and that this is a general giving out of money, and we know that battered women's shelters are very well used and needed, and we appreciate that. It's just that it looks like, and then the counties, all the counties that are getting money out of this at the same amount every year, and one county we had in front of us had a huge budget, a very well-off county, and yet they're still taking funds out of this account, the same as a county that was very small. So small counties, huge counties, workload didn't seem to make a difference. Everybody was getting the same amount, and it just seemed strange to us. And is this, we're just trying to get a control on that. Who knows how many different organizations are going to be asking for money. I mean, don't be afraid is what we're trying to tell the director, is to say no, and you don't have to give out the same amount of money to each one. It was just, and there was a lot of questions that weren't able to be answered by the director. And for somebody that's a director of that program, paid that well, we thought that there would be a lot more questions that should be answered. It just looked like a lot of different divisions seemed like operating in their own with not a lot of communication. So I think that we had, I hope I didn't pass up on the original subject, but Representative Woodard and Senator Jungbauer had questions. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've covered the area I wanted to very well, so thank you.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to say I agree with you wholeheartedly. This year, it seems like we have a lot of testifiers. President Company accepted, I'll say that. We got professional bureaucrats testifying this year at a lot of meetings, and the fiscal notes are a joke. I know I've worked many years at figuring out some ways to save money, and then the departments, and not this specific department, will put a huge fiscal note on there to make sure they don't have to implement the cost savings. And I'm an advocate of public safety. I believe it's one of our constitutional deals, and I'm an advocate to not take money out of dedicated funds. So I agree with you there, but we need some help in understanding this. And what I need when you leave, and I think it'll help all the committee, is, you know, you talk about these mandates. Maybe we can get some bullet points on the mandates that you're covering with all this, and then the mission additions. What has made that budget grow? What were the new missions assigned to the department? And then, you know, if you can't tell us where you'd cut, give us some kind of a, you know, mission critical. What are the top things and work your way down? If you can't, again, if you can't give us some good ideas, give us your hierarchy so that we can try to work off of that. You know, give us something of a backbone to try to head the right direction anyway, and I'd appreciate that so much. Thanks.
Are we at the 40 minutes now for this one? We are. But I can't, anybody got any other questions in this?
Commissioner, one of the areas that we discussed in both chambers was the some of these areas of Office of Justice programs, and namely the Network for Better Futures. I see that there's a few representatives in the room today. They did make some brief presentations while we were in the committee process. But And some of us just had an overall question of why this program is even part of the DPS. It seems like it's more of a correctional program. And I was wondering if someone could give us a brief history first of how did it come about that a rehab program is getting involved in a DPS department.
Commissioner Ellison?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I maybe can help on that. This was in the corrections department at one time, funding for this program. Last biennium, I can't remember if it was last biennium or last year, the Network for Better Futures had a request to the Department of Public Safety, and the Department of Public Safety, through some federal funds, was able to provide a one-time grant to the Network for Better Futures. And so I think when the governor's office was looking at a likely department candidate to carry this, he chose us. I think it could have gone to corrections. It could have gone to human services. It could have gone to commerce. It probably could have gone any number of ways, but it did come to us. I guess that's as good an answer as I can give you at this time.
Do you know why the governor was seeking a separate line item for this while other OJP programs would have to go out and seek or apply for a dollar amount?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I have not discussed this with the governor, so I'm not sure what his thinking was. I think that he was impressed with this program and felt that it had the potential to be cost-effective and therefore had that in his budget.
One of the questions I had is, do you know if all of the funds that this operation has, is it only coming from the state, or do they get federal money and do they get donations? Is this just a small part of it, a sliver of the $2.9 million that they were requesting from the state? Is that a very small percentage of their total revenue stream to make this operation work?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I'm not sure. I would need to ask somebody from the network to answer that question.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you like, network is here if you have direct questions.
One of the staff here? Or?
One of the staff, yes. Do you want to?
Sir, you want to state your name and give you just a short overview?
Sure, Mr. Chair, thank you. My name's Steve Thomas. I'm with the Network for Better Futures. To your question, Senator Limmer, the 2.9 that's requested in the governor's budget would provide about 38% of our total income for the upcoming biennium. The rest is primarily private funding from foundations, and about $1 million for the next biennium would be earned income from our business enterprise.
Sir, a couple of the things that stuck out so much was the salary of your director, even though some in the state have defended nonprofit salaries. It seems to be very high, and also the number of staff and their salaries, and then how many people the network serves for the amount of money. It seemed kind of a funny ratio as compared to the equivalent programs in the Department of Corrections. Could you address that? Or?
As Commissioner Ellison said, the Board of Directors surveys comparable salaries for similar positions, not only here but nationwide, and that's how those are set. As the directors is all is funded with grant private money. No state money has ever been used, or any public money has ever been used to fund the director. And in terms of the cost of the service, it relative to the cost of incarcerating for someone for a year, it's significantly less.
Okay, thank you, sir. Any questions for members?
Senator
Limmer.
So, Mr. Thomas, if the state receives 40%, a 2.9 would represent 40% of the budget. Then roughly the operation costs a total of $7.2 million, give or take a little. And former inmates are involved per year in this program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, that your number is approximately correct. So over the next biennium, we would expect to enroll and serve about 340 ex-offenders. And before the three previous years before this year, we've enrolled and served over 430 high-risk men.
I noticed that the Department of Corrections has a reentry program that they have. It's probably not as detailed as what you offer, but I think there's close to 6,000 individuals that go through this program in a biennium, and that cost is $2 million to the state. And what we're asked to fund of $2.9 million, it would only be applied to 340 inmates per year. So that raises a lot of eyebrows on our behalf. Mm-hmm. So just for the scope versus the scale of the dollar amount per person. And that, in a time of really tight markets, that's kind of the bottom line that at least I have to deal with is we may be getting a better bang for the buck due to the success of your program, but at the same time, it seems like it's extremely costly per individual to go through it. And that, I don't know if you have any comment about it, but that's kind of the hard, cold numbers that, right, that we have to analyze this year.
Mr. Chair, just briefly, if I may.
Yes, briefly.
Senator Limmer, I understand that point. I think there's a couple of key points to remember. In these desperate times, we've got to start investing in innovative reforms. So this is a one-time contribution, and we're committed to completing an independent evaluation. And one of the key indicators that we want to be held accountable for is, can we significantly reduce recidivism rates? And so that's why we would suggest that this investment, we want to be held accountable for significantly reducing recidivism, which over time can help reduce the number of people who return, which is a big driver on correction costs.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Is there anything you'd like to say and before we get into the next commissioner's testimony?
Mr. Chair and members, I'd just like to say thanks. I understand that this is a tough position that we're all in, and I appreciate the opportunity to present to you today, and thank Commissioner Ellison as well.
If I could just ask Director Berger one more question. Director, you're aware that I have a clause in there in the bill about turning over the responsibility of the DOC website to the BCA website. In general, in your professional opinion, if you were given the proper resources to do that, do you feel you could take over that duty and keep the public safe and operate that facility from the BCA, both as you and I have talked about it before?
If given the proper resources, yes.
Okay.
Did you have one question, sir, on the police training? I could answer that.
Okay, go ahead quickly.
The police training and development section actually includes police training, but it also is the missing persons, Amber Alert, Crime Alert Network, and administrative services also at the BCA, which is basically support staff. So that's that piece of it.
Okay, thank you, sir. Commissioner Lindsay. Commissioner, we'll so that you get your full 40 minutes, we're going to add time if we need it on to give you as long as you'd like until 2:10 or 14:10 in military time. So you can go ahead and give us your opening remarks, sir.
Thank you, Representative Cornish, and thanks to the committee. I want to start with just a general overview just to ensure that everyone is on the same page as it relates to sort of the work which is done by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights and why it is important to the state of Minnesota. There are three main objectives currently under the statute.
You could speak just a little bit louder.
Okay.
Closer to the mic there. There we go. Thank you, Commissioner.
There are three main objectives under the statute: contract compliance, enforcement investigation, education outreach. Specifically as it relates to contract compliance, one of the things that it's important to ensure is that all citizens in the state of Minnesota have a fair and equal shot and opportunity to do work on behalf of the state. The Minnesota Department of Human Rights ensures that individuals do have that opportunity to work on contracts which are bid out and let out by the state of Minnesota. Currently, people of color are unemployed at a rate 3 times greater than those. That is significant. Even in controlling for education and other opportunities to explain the difference, that is still significant. That suggests that there is institutional issues and bias which prevent people from color from having an opportunity. This past Friday, I was at a seminar hosted by Wells Fargo Foundation. Dr. Algernon Austin presented to the respective group. There were many corporations there in attendance. They were all very interested to figure out what things are going on in the state of Minnesota which are preventing equal opportunity for people of color in this state to participate in the economics which are going on in the state. It is a significant problem, one that we should address and not avert our eyes to in asking difficult questions and looking for those answers. This is important work that the Department of Human Rights is doing in the area of contract compliance. As it relates to education outreach, also this past Friday, there was a report, a story in the paper by the Star Tribune of a Somali family having KKK and swastikas printed on their home, and 3 other instances of such vile acts. It's important that we do not lose sight of the fact that not everyone understands the beautifulness of diversity within our state, and that it's important for education and outreach to continue within this respective state. Access to courtrooms. The court has contacted the Department of Human Rights to ensure that issues concerning those with disabilities, that they are not prevented from having access to the courtrooms. That is something that the Department of Human Rights is working on, and it's an important work that needs to continue. A lot of people believe or are under the false impression that this is an issue which is only located to the 7-county metro. It is not the case. The highest concentration of growth of people of color is actually occurring outside of the 7-county metro area. This state is becoming significantly more diverse. If you look at the data as it's been provided, there are 2 phenomenons which are going and are significant in our state. The state is getting significantly older, and the state is also getting significantly diverse. It's important that we have dialogue so we can bridge these respective differences in a constructive manner, and the department facilitates that meaningful dialogue, and it should continue. Finally, the department also works in the area of investigations, discrimination investigations. For those who I have not met, I have met with most of the individuals in one-on-one meetings, and I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you. I've been practicing law in the area of employment for more than 20 years. There is no more effective means of alternative dispute resolution than the Department of Human Rights. The department receives less than $4 million a year. On average, it resolves more than 1,000 charges. If you take into consideration the ones that do not even resolve in a formal charge being written, the number is even greater. But if you just look at those 2 numbers, that means, on average, the Department of Human Rights is resolving a harassment charge at a rate of $4,000 a year. And that's not even taken into consideration what is being done by the Department of Human Rights in the area of contract compliance and education. $4,000 a year. It costs, on average, about $250 to file a complaint in district court. By the time that an answer has been drafted and discovery is sent out, more than $4,000 has been spent. The department provides a very vital and important work for the state of Minnesota just in the area of dealing with harassment investigations. What is significant about the respective issues which are going on and other pieces of legislation going on here at the Capitol. On Friday and earlier this morning, I sat in on the state government finance bill. They're proposing a cut of 10%, they're proposing a cut as it relates to administrative agencies. If that cut was provided proportionally across all agencies, it would roughly be a 10% cut. As it relates to FTE cuts in the bill being proposed by the state government bill, that would be about a 15% cut. Now, again, in fairness to what's going on in the state government bill, there's negotiation and there's difference between the House and Senate position. But as someone who is charged with trying to figure out what are the alternatives going forward, I have to tell you that I then have to add what is being proposed by this respective group. What that means is that the legislature is proposing a 75% to 90% cut to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. In essence, it appears that the legislature is saying to eliminate and eradicate the Department of Human Rights. We currently budget right now 80 to 82% on wages. There is no way in which the department, understanding that it has fixed costs that it is still responsible for, such as computer software, and it has to turn on the lights, there is no way that the department can effectively go forward and operate under such a scenario. I know that there has been discussion in the past that there are other entities out there that can pick up the work of the department, and I would be remiss not to say, as relates to the area of investigations, that's not true. The EEOC can pick up some of the slack as it relates to the work which is done by the Department of Human Rights, but it cannot pick up the entire slack of what is being done by the department. The EEOC has a backlog of over 86,000 cases, and by 2015 it has reported to Congress that it expects to have a backlog of more than 115,000 cases. The EEOC only takes a portion by the subject matter of the cases done by the Department of Human Rights, and that is in the area of employment. The Department of Human Rights does more cases beyond just simply the area of employment. Then as it relates to the city of Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's important to remember that only 20 to 25% of all the cases filed with the Department of Human Rights could be picked up by those respective departments, and that presumes, and it's not a valid presumption, that they were in a position to actually pick up those cases. Both the city of Minneapolis and city of St. Paul are operating at full capacity now. They're not in a position to be able to pick up any of the cases jurisdictionally which are filed in those respective cities. I started in this position on March 2nd. July 11th, the department submitted a report to the legislature indicating that on average it was taking between 410 to 423 days to issue no probable cause or probable cause findings. Any cut will have a dramatic impact, and we'll see that number go higher. The one bill that's before this committee, the 50 or 65% cut, it is fair to say would at least double, if not more so, the time spent to be able to do probable cause or no probable cause determinations. That is three times beyond the statutory mandate. These cuts are deep and significant. I appreciate the difficult task that you have before you. If there are questions, I will stand for all the questions that the committee has. And again, I respect Chair Cornish and Chair Lemmer. If there are additional questions, if we can't address before 1:10, I can follow up in writing. I have someone from my office follow up in writing and answer those respective questions.
Commissioner Lindsay, welcome. I The only problem I had with your statement was when it looked like we were attempting to eliminate or obliterate your department. We certainly aren't unfortunately prejudiced and gets a lot of different people are is alive and well in this state, and we realize the need for your department. We're just trying to talk about the direction. One tough question for you to start off, when we talk about direction, if you could furnish us with how much money you spent on defending this witch at the Stillwater prison. We've got a bad individual out there serving a double life sentence for grisly murders, and recently you come up with a determination of probable cause, unfair discriminatory practice was committed, and now your department and the AG's office is spending a lot of money, and that's because he didn't get his herbs and oils and whatever else he uses for his celebrations there. So I'm just wondering if that's the right direction your department should be taking. Why is that a priority, and how much money you're spending on something like that?
Mr. Chair, do you have the name of the respective charging party?
Stephen Hodgson is a Stillwater prison inmate serving two consecutive life sentences for 1991 murders. It was a big thing in the Minneapolis Tribune, I believe, where they highlighted his case that the Department of Human Rights had found a probable cause to unfair discriminatory. Are you familiar with this case?
What year?
This year, just in the last month or two. And the case, when he murdered the people, was 1991. But the deal was the prison wasn't giving him his oils and herbs and other things that he needed for his whatever Wiccans do. And now we're taking it on full scale with the Department of Human Rights and the AG's office. And it just seems like when we talk about direction, when there's swastikas being painted in people's houses, the money would be a better spent catching those people than it would be chasing down herbs and oils for. And I'm not trying to be flippant about it, but it's just one of the things when we were talking about education and outreach in the original appearance in front of our committee. And so things like this pop up as a red flag.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question. I'm not intimately familiar with the respective facts of this dispute, but on the basis of what you said, I'd like to make a few comments to the committee. The first is that you indicated that Mr. Hodgkins is Wicca or Wiccan.
I think Wiccan was the term.
And I believe that that has been a practice which has been recognized by the United States Supreme Court as having deference under the First Amendment, which is important because all rights are important. And while I or you or maybe members of this committee don't believe that someone who practices Wiccan is entitled to the same deference under the law as it's been set out by the United States Supreme Court, I believe that someone who does practice that is entitled to rights under the United States Constitution. Now, as it relates to oils or herbs, there are many religious practices in which oils and herbs are used. Again, we personally may disagree with that particular respective religious practice, but in order to ensure that all have rights as relates to their religious beliefs and what they practice, it's important that there not be made a distinction as it relates from the personal belief of the individual who sits in judgment or is in a tribunal. As it relates to the amount, you characterize it as we were taking on the case, and I think it's important to make sure that there is a distinction as it relates to the work which is done by the Department of Human Rights. And that is, we are a neutral tribunal. We review the information before and we make a determination. But to take on suggests an advocacy standpoint. So this is not a case in which we would have went into the jail and decided to represent Mr. Hodgkins going forward as an attorney might in private practice. So I think that there is a distinction there. So what the department would have done, not knowing specifically the intimate details of this case, is that they would have received a charge by a prison inmate. And under the case law set forth by the United States Supreme Court, they would make a determination whether that was entitled to due deference under Supreme Court case law. I assume the investigator made such a determination, and understanding case law that I do as relates to Wiccan, that at least a starting point would have been that would have been a religious belief or a practice which would have been entitled to some deference. Now, again, I don't know more than that as it relates to just what you provided, but at that point in time, the information would have been given to the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General's office would have attempted to conciliate a resolution of the respective dispute.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I'm good to see you back before the committee again.
Thank you.
A couple of things come to my mind when you speak. First of all, you're very passionate, and I really appreciate your passion on these issues. They are so important to Minnesotans, and I think everyone here in this room is committed to making sure that we eliminate all discrimination whenever possible. So with that said, though, there seems to be an assumption in your comments that there are not opportunities for private sector answers to discrimination, in particular causes of action that might be brought by private attorneys. There are also attorneys' fees that are authorized for folks that actually prevail in some of these cases. And so I think if you say that we cut your budget, it automatically doubles or triples the time for turnaround to an action, I'm not sure I'm convinced of that. And so if you can show me why you believe that in a more statistical way, I would be appreciative of that. Secondly, I'm always skeptical now when people tell me they need more money for education and outreach. I'm skeptical because every agency, everybody is doing education and outreach, and I'm just not sure we're doing that as effectively and efficiently as we can. And so everybody wants to have a component of that, and I think we need to concentrate those dollars into the most effective uses. And so I would ask you to go back and look at your budget again and say, do you need every last dollar you have for education and outreach, and can you verify for us that that is efficient and effective in the use? Because every law enforcement agency in the state has it. Our state agencies all have education and outreach aspects. We have counties and cities all working on education outreach. Schools all working on education outreach. So please show me why the dollars that you have in your budget that you're trying to defend are the most, or the best spent of all the dollars we have available for education and outreach.
Commissioner Lindsay.
Senator Ortman, I appreciate the questions and comment. He asked two questions. One, sort of what happens in the private marketplace. I would say that reviewing the files which come to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, there are cases which are vitally important, but the private marketplace does not recognize them because it's hard to generate a high economic damage award before a jury. So, for instance, when someone's right has been violated, unless they can show a loss of wage, it's difficult for the private marketplace to view that case as worthwhile and then taking, even if there are attorney fees involved. And I'll give the committee an example of why that might be the case, but yet why it's a significant right. All of us are familiar with Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks was sitting on a bus and was told that she had to give up her seat for someone else because of the skin color, of her skin color. What is the lost wages for Rosa Parks? The ride of bus fare? Now, all of us understand that it's significant when someone tells you that you're not as worthy as someone else and you have to give up something as fundamental as that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the economic marketplace is going to recognize that, take on that respective case. The Department of Human Rights has a lot of cases within its portfolio, and I wish, unfortunately, under the Data Practices Act, I can share more with you. But there are a lot of cases which fundamental rights of individuals are impacted. But yet it's difficult to show economic damages such that attorneys will not take, well, unfortunately, not enough attorneys. I shouldn't say all. Not enough attorneys are willing to take on those cases. So the second part of your question in there is sort of the doubling of time. And what I would say to you is I have, in the first 60 days I've been there, I've actually sat down, met with all of my enforcement officers who are in charge with investigations, looking at ways in which we can reduce the amount of time. And I think that there are some things in which I could do, and we can do together, I should say it that way, to reduce the amount of time as it relates to investigations. But if we're talking about a 50% cut or a 65% cut, it's a dramatic reduction in the number of people who are going to be around to be able to effectively do the investigations. The number of cases is not going to dramatically drop by 50 or 65%. Having fewer people is going to cause us a longer time in which to be able to do those investigations. There's no way in which we can use technology in a way to ensure that there is a drop in the time frame to be able to do those cases. The last thing I think I heard within, I guess it was three questions. The third one was the education. In reviewing the documentation as relates to the department spends somewhere between 5 and 6% of its budget on education outreach activities. It is not a significant amount of money which is spent on education outreach activities. The people that I've spoken with in the communities believe that more information should be provided. And please do not take the next comment sort of as a knock as relates to the legislative process. And it's probably a part failure, even on my part, to be more civically involved and engaged. But in looking at the testimony and the people who show up at these respective hearings, there needs to be more people of color here at the legislature, not as it relates to the Department of Human Rights. There needs to be a buy-in as relates to this is their state, because there are a lot of issues which impact them. And if we are going to have a great state, we have to be at the table.
Commissioner, I've got four or five people. Representative Woodard, Senator Limmer, Senator Jungbauer, Senator Ortman, and Representative Kelly left here before now on 210.
Mr. Chair, if you would forgive me, I asked the question. He responded. If I could speak to that point.
Sure, Senator Ortman.
I would appreciate it. Thank you for the courtesy. Commissioner, a couple of things that you said. I disagree with the analogy to Rosa Parks. Nobody here wants to encourage discrimination, least of all me. But that case is very different. We've had 40 years of civil rights law that has developed since that case. And I don't think that case would happen again. Certainly you wouldn't. Now, I'm not saying that there are no more instances of discrimination. But what I am saying is I think we can prioritize the resources to address discrimination, and I hope you'll help us do that. I think you've acknowledged in the answer that there is a private marketplace and there are attorneys and attorney's fees that are authorized even when there are no economic damages. And so there are attorneys that are taking these cases. And I would say maybe that's one of the areas you could prioritize. You could say this is not the type of case that could be heard in the private market, and so then maybe the department should look even more closely at these types of cases or investigate these types of cases. But it's incumbent upon all of us to prioritize the resources of the state of Minnesota. And I would say to your last comment, we here at this table do represent, as best we can, all Minnesotans. And I think the administration seems to forget that I represent the residents of Carver and Scott County, but also the interests of all Minnesotans, regardless of their background. And I'm not sure why you don't acknowledge that when we sit here at this table and say we are concerned about these residents, all of them.
Mr. Chair, could I respond?
Commissioner Lindsay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, on your last point, let us be clear. I was not making a comment as relates to who you represent. But to the extent that if we look around this particular room and we look around as it relates to other rooms, as it relates during the legislative session, to the extent that there needs to be more people of color in the room at this table and other parts of discussion and development of policy, that is a good goal, I think, for the entire state of Minnesota. there are a variety of different bills in which I have heard which impacted people of color, which for a variety of different reasons they did not feel a part of. So, for example, voter ID bill, an adoption bill, integration funding, adult certification for criminal, as it relates to minors. That's a couple off the top of my head, and having conversations with people around the state, which I think they would have appreciated the opportunity to be more at the table. That doesn't necessarily mean how that would have impacted, doesn't necessarily mean how it would have changed votes. It's just to be part of the process. As it relates to the prioritization of cases, on that point, I would agree with you that the department has to be wise as it relates to its use of resources. If there are cases in which the private marketplace is going to take on those cases, that may be a point in which the department should not take on those respective cases. So again, if there is a situation in which there's a private attorney which is assisted in filing the response of charge, that may not necessarily be a case in which the department is going to take on full use of its resources in that case. But the vast majority of cases do not have a private attorney which files a response of charge to the department. On your first point, Rosa Parks, I would have to disagree with you. I don't think anyone would say that an instance of a black person riding on public transportation would be denied, but that does not mean it's not occurring within the state of Minnesota. And I will give you an instance as it relates to the loss of dollar value and an example. Recently, there was a young lady who was denied assistance by her sister in a changing room. And in that respective case, it was because she had autism and needed assistance. There, the store denied the sister from coming in. So again, facilitating the use of a commercial enterprise, she was treated differently because of her disability. So are those cases going on as it relates to treating individuals differently as it relates to a disability or some other protected status? Yes, those cases still are going on. Now, does that mean that it is rampant in the same way in the 1950s or 1960s? No, it is not. But that does not mean that it's not going on.
Commissioner, we've got four questions. If you could keep your answers just a little shorter. We're trying to respect your time and get all the things vetted here because we won't have a lot of time for in the future for public testimony like yours or for agency testimony. Representative Woodard, then Senator Limmer, and then down the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Lindsay, I appreciate you being here today. I know I was a little concerned in your letter. You had mentioned that you look forward to talking to us after this conference committee report had been complete. So I appreciate you being engaged in this part of the process to help us better understand it. I appreciate that. Also in your letter, you talked a little bit about the concerns you have with human rights in Minnesota. I guess really the question goes to what Senator Ortman has talked about here, that we all understand that there are needs from a human rights perspective here in the state. I would argue that funding in education that helps the achievement gap, different programs and priorities in education, K through 12 education, that allows for minorities and different groups within the state to have the education they deserve is money well spent. I think the argument here, or at least the discussion that we're having today, is where do these dollars best make the most impact or make the most impact in this area? And you mentioned that we have all these issues, and we've spent, you mentioned almost $8 million per biennium on the things that you do and the things that you prioritize. And I would tell you that the thing that drives Minnesotans nuts is that when we spend money on things like this and then we hear about the Hodgkin case, which is him suing our own state Department of Corrections, and we defend him, the Department of Human Rights turns around and defends him against that case, that does drive people a little nuts, that's not the kind of human rights we think of when we think of what your department does. So I guess the bottom line question here is, if we were to fully fund your department again, what sort of things would happen that would reduce the things that you've been working on now for many years with the budget that you've had? What would make this next biennium any different?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Woodard, as relates to the Hodgkins case, I would say is probably an outlier without looking at the number of cases. One of the things which is a challenge as relates to agencies such as ours and the court system itself is that the court system is charged with applying the law and applying the Constitution. And as an attorney for over 20 years, there are things which are said as relates to when I was a kid by individuals marching in Skokie that I find repulsive and vile, but I still understood in the First Amendment that they had a right to say those things. So I'm not quite sure if you're saying that we should not uphold a PC finding if there is a legal theory in place to uphold the decision. The Constitution is important, and we have to stand by it, even when we sometimes, from a personal level, might disagree with the activity that the individual is engaging in. As it relates to the budget, it's important to make sure that people understand that the budget for the Department of Human Rights is 3.341. I rounded up to $4 million. So it's good money well spent from my vantage point as it relates to the number of cases, contract compliance, and the work that we're doing in education. I would say what I want to do going forward, though, is to be more proactive with the agency, and that is to work constructively on things and not focus all of the time or most of the time on investigations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Limmer and then Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome back to the committee. I think I'd like to take the questions in a little different direction. You talked about determining probable cause for your agency, and the average was 400 to 410 days per case. And I was wondering, is probable cause the same probable cause in your department as in a criminal investigation by a police department?
Senator Limmer, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question. The answer is no. It is not exactly the same.
Could you explain the difference?
I think when, Senator Limiter, Mr. Chair, as relates to probable cause, there is a reasonable basis to believe that discrimination has occurred in the civil context. Probable cause in the criminal context, I would probably need a little bit more. And is it probable cause to believe to justify a search, to justify an arrest? It would mean a little different of answer to your question.
The reason I've raised it is that, you know, an investigation lasting over 400 days, over a year per case, to me seems kind of excessive. And maybe since I'm not aware of every investigation, and if that's an average, then some will take far less and some might take a lot longer. And I was just wondering because usually when government gets involved with an individual's life in an accusatory way, a probable cause has to be first established before government can step in and either hinder the rights of someone in the background of, let's say, a criminal investigation. And I haven't done any studies on how long it takes an average police officer to conduct a determination of probable cause, but I would tend to think that it's a lot less than over a year. And so I'm trying to understand your workload and the perhaps disjointed or the extended investigations of what it takes to react to at least catch up to the 86,000 backlog cases that you claim you have. And maybe that's part of the concern that the legislature has in determining budget. To me, you know, for lack of a better understanding, 400 days is a long time to keep a file active to determine if someone legitimately or has a legitimate claim that some discrimination occurred to them. Why would it take over a year to determine that?
Commissioner.
Senator Limmer and Mr. Chair, there are several reasons for that. But I think in the interest of time, I'll give you a short response and then follow up later. The short response is this, is that the department is also reviewing such cases to see if they would withstand a motion for summary judgment, which would mean that there is sufficient facts for a court to submit the matter to jury trial. Probable cause as it relates to an arrest would just be that the individual has presented enough information such they could be bound over to be brought before a magistrate or judge for arrest, different respective standard. That's part of it, but there are other reasons as relates to cases coming over from the EEOC. There's some staffing questions, but that is also part of it. But let me say this in closing on that respective question. The amount of time of 410 and 423 days, I have that as priority one of changing. It is taking the department entirely too long to issue no probable cause or probable cause findings, and I will change that.
Okay. And, Commissioner, I want you to know that we all know you're inheriting an agency, and you've only been on the job for maybe max 2 months, and you're inheriting perhaps an office culture that might be a little slower. We don't know all of the details, so bear with us. One other comment that I wanted to make, and you had said that there needs to be more people of color in the audience seeing how we do business. I might expand on that a little bit. I just wish more citizens would come here. Because if I was going to take a poll of the people in this room right now, you'd probably have, and I bet I would be close to 100%. There's people of three groups. They're legislators. There's lobbyists, and then there's the bureaucrat population in the state of Minnesota. And I would venture to guess there's probably hardly any real, live, legitimate citizen that doesn't have an interest in any of those three that I just mentioned. So it's not just people of color that don't come here. It's all of our citizens don't get involved in enough of the work that goes on in this building. And I've sat here and watched the audience for a long time, and it's really kind of a nature of the beast right now. We'd like to encourage every citizen to come over here and see how we do business, especially the meetings that go way deep into the night. That's the time when they really need to come over here. So I think you and I probably would agree to that.
Senator Emery, Mr. Chair, I totally agree with that.
And Senator Jungbauer will get in another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Lindsey. I do like your thoughtful responses. You engage me in your answers. Looking at your organization being smaller, per se, than other organizations, and given the fact you've only been on there a little while, I heard you say one thing, that you can't use technology to move things quicker or ahead. And this, kind of based off of that, do you think, you're talking about shortening up some of these things, will you be looking at the department and saying, is there a way to restructure? We hear over and over, and I've only been here a small amount of time compared to Senator Limmer, but I get so tired of hearing from departments, we just need more money. You know, I ran a business for 25 years. That's not how it worked. You restructured every year based on the realities of the market. Granted, this isn't a business, but there's different realities going on. Are you the kind of guy that's going to look for the restructuring and answer about the technology issue that kind of perplexed me?
Senator Jungbauer and Mr. Chair, just so that we're clear as it relates to the technology, what I was trying to get across there, and let me make sure that there's no confusion, just simply using the technology which exists now, the level of cuts, we would not be able to reduce the amount of time for probable cause or no probable cause. We do have to use technology, and we have to use it smartly. There's no doubt about that. Individuals at the department will tell you the reason why I met with all the enforcement officers is to retool and examine the whole process. So tomorrow there will be a meeting as it relates to sort of what the commissioner has learned in the first 60 days as it relates to the enforcement process, and we will have some suggestions as to how we're going to do things differently.
Let's see if mine is on there.
Thanks.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner,
Back in the mid-90s, the legislative auditor suggested merging the department with a larger agency like the Attorney General's Office. And it's my understanding right now that approximately 17 other states operate this way. Is that something the department should be looking at? And this is certainly about efficiencies and where we're at, whether we expand government or reduce government. But is there an efficiency there that we could possibly benefit from?
Commissioner Lindsay?
Representative Kelly and Chair, Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of studies out there examining the efficacy of merging a department such as ours with the Attorney General's office, but it is an issue which warrants examination.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, members. I think next meeting will be at the call of Senator Limmer. Any announcements at this time? Okay. And if there's no questions or comments, meeting adjourned. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See you.